WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
Well, one of the most anxiously awaited films scheduled to open this winter is The King of Comedy, which stars Robert De Niro and Jerry Lewis and is directed by Martin Scorsese. With me is Paul Zimmerman, who wrote the screenplay for the film. He began work on the script in around 1970. When it was completed, he sent it to Robert De Niro, who expressed interest in it, but it took several years before he was ready to commit to it. Zimmerman was the movies editor of Newsweek from 1971 to 77. He also was the books editor for Newsweek for a year. He's written several other as yet unproduced screenplays, and his latest was commissioned by actress Goldie Hawn. He's also the author of the book The Marx Brothers at the Movies. Mm-hmm. Paul Zimmerman lives in Bucks County, where he's recently become active in the Bucks County Alliance for Nuclear Disarmament. Actually, the acronym is BAND. That's the Bucks Alliance for Nuclear Disarmament. He helped to found this group. It's a coalition of 20 Bucks County church and secular organizations working for a nuclear freeze. And as we'll hear a little later, they're bringing in Helen Caldicott, and she'll be speaking on September 30th at 7:30 at the Neshaminy Langhorne High School. She's the head of Physicians for Social Responsibility. Well, we'll hear about that a little bit later. But first, we're going to talk about this upcoming film, The King of Comedy. And Paul Zimmerman, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you very much. You say anxiously awaited. I was thinking 13 years is a long time to wait. if you think you're anxiously awaiting it, imagine how I feel.
When did you write it, 1970?
Well, I got the idea in 1970. I got it in a combination of things. I read a piece in Esquire where a guy kept a diary of the talk show hosts, and he wrote about them as if they were his buddies. And then I saw on David Susskind's show, he had autograph hunters, and I thought, what if an autograph hunter thought one of these talk show hosts was a buddy? And I also had vague notions of assassination and other things that have held up, unfortunately, too well over the period. That's one of the few satisfactions of this long wait, is that the story holds up extremely well, even though 13 years usually it perishes. But this holds up. The talk show hosts aren't as big as they were then. That was when Cavett and Bishop and Griffin and Carson, and those were the shows. My wife calls them cocktail parties without drinks, but they're, anyway, she gets to sleep from them, but most people, they kept them awake. And otherwise, it's all held up pretty well, and I wrote the thing after a while. I wrote a treatment. I actually went to David Picker. I was the Newsweek editor, and I didn't realize the power I had as a Newsweek movie editor. I didn't take myself seriously enough in that sense. And he said, well, why don't you write the first five scenes? I told him something about it, and he was the head of UA at that time. And I wrote the first five, and I didn't like just writing five, so I wrote an 85-page story called A Treatment, and I never took it to him for some reason. It got all sidetracked. It got to Bob Evans, who gave it to Milos Forman, who read it and said, yeah, I'd like to, you know, whatever. And Milos came out to our house in Bucks County when my wife was 9 months pregnant and lived with us. And we spent 8 or 10 weeks on it. Actually, she was 7.5 months pregnant when he got there, and we had our daughter when he left. And it didn't work out at all, and I rewrote it. Actually, we got some good ideas together, but the thing went in the wrong direction, because I'll tell you a little about it. It's about an anonymous comedian who meets a talk show host. The talk show host says, call my office, and he lives his life from there on as though he's made it, because he's paid his dues. He's talented, and now this is his break. But he's actually a total fantasist. And he goes living his life, and he does call the office. And the whole story follows from there, logically, to its conclusion, where he does get on the show. And I won't say a lot more about it. If you want to tell people what you know about it, fine. But I don't want to give away the plot that we worked so hard to put together. At any rate, I sat down and did it. And then Milos had a version that he sent around. He had the hero as a kind of normal taxi driver type. And what this fellow does just isn't normal. And so it didn't work. And they sent it out anyway, because in the business, the director is the key, not the writer. So better to send a totally failed misbegotten project with a director on it than a brilliant script that works with a writer on it. And so they went on with Milos's, and he and Buck Henry went to Sweden, where his girlfriend was living, and they spent quite some time writing a second draft of it, which was also unproducible, and I was waiting during this time. And finally, when it had exhausted itself, and Milos went on to do Cuckoo's Nest, which was a wonderful movie, I started sending mine out, and I sent it to Bob De Niro. I sent it to Marty Scorsese. I knew them both marginally, and Marty said, I can't do this. I have a friend. It turned out to be Jay Cox of Time magazine, my so-called rival, even though we never looked at each other that way. He was doing movies at Time. I was doing them at Newsweek. And he said, it's on comedy, and I feel a commitment. And I said, we'll send it to Bob De Niro. And I went away for the summer. Everything happens to me when I go away for the summer. When I got back, I got a call from Bobby's agent, Harry Ufflin, saying Bobby loves it, blah, 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 and, you know, raving on would I meet with him and talk with him. And I did. And he talked about it the way I had dreamed someone would understand it. And he said, I have a few movies, though, a few commitments. And it turned out he had six movies. And that was in 1974. And it took till 1982, and I waited, because he was the right person. But by that time, Mike Cimino, who did Heaven's Gate, had been on it and off it. And Marty Scorsese read it again and liked it. Same guy, same script. Nothing had changed, but he decided he wanted to do it. And it finally, this was about 1980, and then it was finally went into production in 82, or 81, I guess. It's taken so long, and it was supposed to come out at Christmas, but for reasons that are complicated and boring, it will be coming out in February. So that is the whole story of The King of Comedy, in its all its grisly detail.
This might be giving away too much to go into this, but what did De Niro say that made you realize that he understood it in the way you hoped?
Well, he just understood. He just raved about it. I don't even remember the details. I was just floating around, you know, listening. Yeah, right. He said, it's so simple. It's so this. The drive of the guy. It is about an obsessive person, a totally obsessive, obsessed person who won't take no for an answer, who simply will not take no, who must exist. He wants to get his 10 minutes in the sun, in the cathode sun, on the video, on that thing that dominates American life so completely. He wants to have existed. And once he tastes it, he'll do anything to get on, and he does, and he gets on. And whether he's any good or not is another question that will be answered by you either reading the reviews and knowing before you go in, and that'll spoil it a little, or just going and seeing it.
Paul Zimmerman is my guest, and he wrote the screenplay for The King of Comedy, which is scheduled to open this winter. You've already seen the film.
Without music, a rough cut. I've seen a smooth rough cut, a sort of second rough cut.
How does the film compare with what you had imagined when you were writing it?
Well, the odd thing that's kind of interesting is that all the scenes are the same. All the characters are basically the same. They're not played by people. I imagined them. They're cast looking different, but the characters are very close, and yet the tone of the film is completely different from what I imagined. Mine was an optimistic, sunny comedy with tremendous tension and pain in it. His is a dark, dark kind of, I can't call it optimistic, even though it ends, you know, without tragedy. There's no violence in it. There's no, nothing like Raging Bull. It's just a dark tone. He sees a dark world, and all the jokes are there, and the same story happens, and yet I feel removed from it. I think it's a very interesting movie. I can guarantee people who go, and I'm really not on here to push it, but I just think that people who go will not feel that they wasted their time, that it was a trivial film. It's a very important, serious, multi-layered film. But it's not the fun that I thought, even though there's lots of laughs in it. There's not the same fun that had I directed it, less well but differently, that there would have been. And in a way, it was disappointing to me. In another way, it's quite wonderful. I mean, when you think of all the other possibilities, that it could have been done stupidly, trivially, it could have been rewritten, that parts of it could be taken out that were essential to it, could be twisted, mutilated, spindled, folded, you know, all the things that you're not supposed to do to computer cards they could have done to the movie. You know, I have to be pleased with it, but it's like looking at a child that you know is yours but doesn't resemble you. It's a strange kind of thing. You know, that's my
offspring, and yet it doesn't look the way I imagined it would. So it's a very complicated thing. I mean, it's a terrific movie, but not the movie that I had in my head when I wrote it. And I'm sure that my feeling that however many writers there are listening who've had movies made know exactly what I mean.
But the script's still basically the same, even though
absolutely the same scenes, the same everything. There's some improvisation, and it's all good.
What could you put your finger on? What was done to change the tone so much with the same script?
Well, for one thing, there's a girl that Rupert falls in love with. Rupert Pupkin is the hero. That's the name of the comedian, the aspiring, perspiring comedian. And he goes, once he gets his break, he goes to the bar where his high school flame is working now, having failed as an ice skating starlet. She wound up in the chorus, and now she's just trying to get through the day and the night and whatever. And I imagined her as a kind of Meryl Streep, Sally Struthers, fallen blonde cheerleader, angel, mainstream, and is against his endless optimism. And they cast Bobby De Niro's wife as Rita, and she is a black woman named Diane Abbott, who does a terrific job, but right away all the characters are even more fringe than what I wrote. They're even less at the center of things. There's a girl who's a confederate of Rupert's named Masha, who's very strange, and I wrote her strange, but she's even stranger. And so what you have here is a kind of shadow world of peripheral people who are kind of circling like satellites around the glamour of Jerry Langford, who is Jerry Lewis. Oddly enough, never thought of him for the part, and the initials are exactly the same, and the first name is the same. Jerry Langford was the name I wrote in 1970. What was very odd is to see that marquee up on 81st Street and Broadway as a writer, to think up something, then pull into New York and see it, to see it exist because you thought of it. It's pretty exciting and heady stuff. So everything is, you know, like, it's like having a movie made is like the rest of life, a mixed experience.
So Jerry Lewis plays the talk
show host, yes.
And De Niro's the comedian.
Comedian, yes.
From the way you describe it, it almost sounds like the different ways that people see Jerry Lewis, you know, because some people think he's, like, really funny, and other people think he's really pathetic.
Well, the Jerry Lewis in this is just simply totally real. And the way that he just plays himself, there's almost none of his comic shtick. He's not supposed to be. In that way, it's never clear, nor is it terribly important whether when he's on his show, he's doing the dan, dan, you know, that sort of nonsense. He plays himself. But Marty has been able to get him. There's a point where he's taken captive, and he hated being out of control, you know, not having Lewis. And the way Marty got the feeling, the depth of feelings, he shot Lewis 15 times the scene. And each time Lewis got madder and madder, and he got feeling out of control. In other words, he replicated in the way he did the scene the feeling the character would have, being told what to do, not having a voluntary control over where he sat, what he did, what he said. And so by shooting it a certain way, he managed to touch a depth in Lewis that's really true. It's a terrific performance. It will get an Academy Award nomination for Best Supporting Actor, and it should. It really is very, very good. And people will be quite surprised by Jerry Lewis to see him. And it's just the right mix of sort of fallibility, unpleasantness, and humanness. He's not good or bad. It's just as I intended him not to be a villain. This is not a story about heroes and villains. It's more complicated.
So what kind of comedian does De Niro play?
There's a point in which he has a fantasy, and which he's given his cassette tape to Jerry Langford, to Jerry Lewis, to listen to, and it begins with Lewis saying to him, "How do you do it, Rube? How do you do it?" Now, I don't want to steal the material. I just want to know, how do you do it? And what Pupkin says, what De Niro says, is, "I don't know, Jerry. I just take the worst parts of my life and look at them in a funny light." And what happens is the structural sort of build of this thing, the way it works, is that you never hear Rupert's monologue till the very end of the film, and that's what tells you who he is, who you've been watching the whole thing. So the monologue is not only a monologue and a comic climax to the film, but it's also a mini biography of the character you've spent almost 2 hours with, and it finally, it's like the end of the mystery. It tells you who this guy really is and why he's who he is in some way. And it's a lot about me, and it's so funny. A funny story. I was having dinner with Marty because we were working on the end to set it up. We redid the end a little bit at the end just to set up a last scene. And I said to him, it's very revealing. I said to him, I know this is a stupid question, but I'm just curious, if somebody said to you, what's this movie about, what would you say? And he said, me.
Really?
And I said, it's funny, I thought it was about me. So that'll tell you. It tells you a lot about a lot of things, that difference, because it's about both of us, and it's about Bob De Niro, and it's about Jerry Lewis, and it's a true collaboration. One of the great things about working with Marty Scorsese is that he honors the people he works with. He was telling me an ending that Lewis wanted to put on, and I was shaking my head saying, oh, God, what a terrible, And it was a terrible idea, but he said, when Jerry talks about it, don't shake your head. He said, never shake your head when somebody talks to you. You'll never find out what they have to offer. He said, you just listen. You listen to everything. And that's what he did, and he did it with me, and I mean, he honored the stuff I did, and if there was a problem, I would write up a solution. He'd just take it. He'd say, yeah, if he liked it, that's good. There was no sense that what was his, what was mine, whose ego was. He's a real artist that way, and I respect him enormously.
How's the film about you?
Well, I went through a classic unhappy childhood, really awful, awful one, and so did Rupert. And I'm a dreamer, and I live most of my life in the future about things that are going to happen that never do, and so does Rupert, and I have a real interest in being famous, and so does Rupert. I mean, nobody drives into Philadelphia just for the drive on I-95. You know, I like being in the public spotlight. Personally, it satisfies the ham in me or whatever it is, and a need to have existed, that definition of a public self as the self that matters, that Rupert and I share. And I was sort of bred to that by a father who was very achievement oriented, and what you did was who you were, is what you were worth. And I'm not saying it's the best way to live. I certainly wouldn't recommend it a one-dimensional recommendation of what matters in a life. And the more I live, the less it sort of dominating it is. But if you get into a public career, I mean, I did go into teaching for a while. I tried to get a degree, and I realized that teaching wasn't rewarded for, it was scholarship, and that just wasn't for me. I wanted the millions of people screaming and loving me and saying, that's great. And maybe they will indirectly when King of Comedy, or maybe they'll say, yeah, what was that? Huh. And then you have to deal with that, which is probably much more educational and much healthier for you up to a certain point, or at least mixed reviews.
Were you on the set for most of the shooting?
I was in and out. I was in when I would be useful, because watching something being shot, you know, you try and explain to people that the opening scene my family came in for, I borrowed a suit. A friend of mine, because I was supposed to be in a leisure suit, and I had Bob sign it for him, which is here. And a good friend of mine has a nice inside patch of his brown suit that says to Hank from Bob De Niro with best wishes. And I was in for that, and it took the first minute and a half of the film took, I'd say, maybe 22 hours to shoot. So you don't want to hang around at that. If you've ever, I guess it's yachting races move at about the same speed. A sailboat races in Newport, you watch the little sails move by inch distance increments. And it's the same with the film. You shoot, this film took 6 months to shoot and an hour and 50 minutes to see. So you figure 8 hours a day for six days a week, 5 days a week for 6 months, what the ratio is.
Actually, an hour and 15 minutes is really short,
50,
isn't it?
50.
Oh, 50. Oh.
Yeah, well, you have those earphones on.
No, I'm not paying attention.
And who can blame you, really? I mean, I'm barely paying attention. I know most of this, see.
How's it getting released?
Slowly. No,
in February.
I don't know. I think what they're going to do is they're going to put it in your major urban centers where Bobby and Marty's work is popular, and it will get its good reviews. I think it will get very good reviews generally. And they are hoping for a growing hunger in the hinterlands for people to say, when is it coming to my town so I can see the King of Comedy? And when it does, there'll be a rush in which thousands will be trampled, you know, on their way to the theater. That's the strategy, I believe.
Did you watch the telethon a few weeks ago?
No.
Oh, I was wondering what it would have been like for you, having seen him work on the set, to see him in the tell, yeah.
But I mean, that one has very little to do with the other. I mean, when I heard that he was going to be Jerry Langford, at first I was not at all pleased, because I thought, who is it that looks at Jerry Lewis as their ideal comedian? I mean, when I was a kid and saw the Colgate Comedy Hour, that was terrific. But as you get to be a little older, his comedy, I think, is limited. He's very good at what he does, but boy, is he a good actor. And he does this serious, and he's not asked to be funny that way. And he's really very good. Yes.
Having been through this film now, do you feel any more or less like a supporter of the auteur theory, of the fact that there's one person in a film who gets all the ingredients and shapes it, and that film really bears the signature?
Well, it's
of
a
that
complicated question. It depends. I mean, there are some, like, I mean, I think this film structurally works better than any of Marty's other films. This is self-serving because the structure of it is better. And he does not provide the structure. The writer provides the structure, the story, the characters. But he impresses a certain tone and way of seeing. And in that way, he is very much an auteur, in the sense that he ever makes up his movies. Yes, he does to a certain extent, but usually the ones he's made up have not been in control, because he's not a writer and he doesn't have the kind of architectural sense that a writer. He works centripetally. He works to the outside. This movie took a 106-page script, made it into a 3-hour movie, and then cut an hour out. And fortunately, what he cut out was what Milos Forman had put in originally. And what's very odd, the last cut they made, they had to take out a big section of the movie because they were running long, and they took out two of the big opening set pieces in the beginning. And these were good scenes. I mean, they were really, but they were things that Milos wanted that I eventually saw as part of the story that I never felt were really belonged in there. And interestingly enough, months after the shooting, months after most of the preliminary editing, before the final kind of big change, those things that never belonged there in the first place fell away. And it's kind of interesting that something like that happens. It makes you believe in the unity of a certain kind of vision, and that when things go long enough and are treated properly, that which does not belong is expelled. And
having worked closely with Forman and with Scorsese, do you see their films differently now than you did before?
Well, there was a time when I wanted to strangle Milos, but so I saw his films differently. No, I was never resentful personally of him, even though he took this thing in the wrong direction. It was with all the goodwill in the world. That was more or less facetious, although he did make it a much longer trip, King of Comedy, than it had to be. But yes, I think if you know people personally and you see their work, that it does influence, you know, where the personality is showing in the treatment of material. Milos distances things. Milos does not connect in certain ways. Marty doesn't connect in certain ways. I think directors that are auteurs, like Milos is to a certain degree, like Marty, is that they're filming their own dream world, and they're using material that they shape to that end. And to that sense, the overlay is the auteur part. I mean, I'm sure there are some, like Steve Spielberg, who writes some of his own movies, where he's an auteur in a different way, less interesting in some ways than Marty, because it's less personal ultimately. It's more a kind of, it's more technical. His stamp is wonderful action photography, you know, montage. And so there are certainly a lot of directors to whom the word auteur is misapplied. And I think it's a problem for critics when they get an auteur theory to start measuring every movie by it. And I think that's a big mistake. I think you take the movie as it comes, with the life and the intention. I mean, Arthur Hiller's The In-Laws was not an auteur movie. It had a wonderful script. I mean, the same guy did Love Story and The In-Laws. I mean, that's not an auteur. That's a good, solid director who can put it up there. And, you know, and there are mixtures in between where there is a personality like Sidney Pollack, where you have a Sidney Pollack movie. I've worked with him. And there is an impact, but it isn't a strong personality working. It's a sort of attitude of a very conservative and kind of smooth, professional kind of attitude, not a quirky attitude, not a quirky self like Marty or, in some sense, I guess, Coppola. Lucas is a different story, more like Spielberg, you know, you want to ask me the question you asked me before about George Lucas? You were going to ask me about, about that earlier, about his effect on film.
Yeah. I'd like to get to that a little later. A lot of people, I think this is in a lot of arts, think that critics are those who can't, and that they're really outsiders, and since they've never really produced a movie or given a concert performance, that they don't really know what it's like, even though they think they do. And I've heard this sentiment
expressed a lot. That's an incredibly stupid attitude, I think. I mean, you don't have to be able to make a movie to know what's good or bad. I mean, and the old idea is it's easy to tear down. It isn't easy to tear down in an interesting way. It's very difficult to tear down something that comes with all the spin of Hollywood baloney on it and millions of dollars in advertising budget and a lot of deception and false premise and to be able to tell people what's wrong with it and protect them from going out and wasting their time, because most of the movies are lousy today. Everybody knows that. The movies are worse than ever. And it's the critics. The critic is the only person who stands between that multi-billion-dollar ad nonsense and the audience and says, hey, I have nothing to gain or lose from this. The fact is, this is lousy. Stay at home. Or this is the way I see this. If you like this sort of thing. But also, the critic has to be a good writer. He doesn't have to be a good movie maker. He has to be a good writer. That's what you're reading. You're not reading his movies. You're reading his writing. I have very little patience. I have as little patience with that as I do the attitude that critics know more than other people, that somehow their opinion is better than anybody else's. It isn't. Any civilized human being goes to the movies, his opinion is worth just as much as any critic's. The only difference is the critic happens to be a journalist who gets paid for it and can write. But the quality of their response while they're sitting there is just the person. People used to say to me, oh, I loved so-and-so, you know. And I said, well, good for you. You had 2 hours good time, and I had 2 hours lousy time. What do you want from my life, you know? You're getting angry at me for having enjoyed yourself where I didn't. And that's I think critics are given too much respect and too much kind of like every other expert, and I mean, including the nuclear, to tie in the two. But, I mean, there's a tendency in life to let your realtor take care of things that you should take care of, your tax people do the things for you that they should, and to let the movie critics do for you what you should do, and let the generals and the planners that decide whether your children survive or not. And that whole abdication of maturity in a certain way. It's the kind of sense where you see yourself in the world as a child still, and they know better. And it's, I think, our educational system encourages that. And I think it's very dangerous, particularly in a democracy where it counts on people knowing things and being able to judge. It's like a restaurant. If the clientele doesn't know anything, the people in charge turn out worse and worse food because it takes more time, intelligence, thought, and money to turn out a good dish. Same way with democracy. The less demanding, the less vigilant, the less educated people are, the worse job the people who run the things do, because they don't have to do a better job. And that's my own. And it's the same with critics, that people who rely on critics too much to do for them what they should do. I mean, people, if they're really interested in film, they can read more than one review, or they can find out, or they can talk to their friends, or they can actually have seen other movies.
So you're going to read the reviews of King of Comedy when it comes out?
Oh, sure, I'm going to read the reviews. I'm going to read them. I'm going to get upset. I'm going to get angry. I'm going to be pleased. But it's Marty Scorsese's King of Comedy now. It's not Paul Zimmerman's King. For 13 years, one of the binds that a writer's in is that, in a way, the best thing that can happen to him is never have his movie made, because then he doesn't see anything happen to it. It's still his. And there's obvious difficulties with that.
The part of you with all the other scripts in the drawer probably doesn't think that
yes,
at all.
It's like having a Calder mobile of your whole life floating behind you. I have 8 scripts sort of floating around. Oh, and some of them are really very good. Some of them are pretty good. Very few of them are as bad as most of what gets made. And that's quite frustrating.
Do you ever ask yourself why the things get why what gets made as opposed to what doesn't get made?
Well, there's so much luck. There's so much baloney. There's so much wanting to get. It's a lot of things. It's somebody has a deal. Somebody met somebody at a party. The audience is 8 years old and they want to see, you know, poo-poo caca movies. And they, you know, whatever it is, or some actress likes an idea that some director and some Canadian producer and somebody fought and somebody wants to get even with somebody and they want to make this to show them that. I mean, there's so little logic, and everyone's scared. It's like The main thing that controls movies is fear. Fear and greed and a desire for deniability when it falls on its face. In other words, it's not the quality of the script. In fact, my wife was reading that and this is for a play, The Doll's House, which is taking a colossal multi-million dollar nosedive, that the guy put millions of dollars in that and never read the script. In other words, he was willing to risk his backers or his own money and not take an hour and a half out to read the book of the musical. And I imagine that happens a lot of the time. The agents don't read it. Nobody reads it. It's done going to readers. A friend of mine, Peter Benchley, when he wrote Jaws, the novel, over at Universal, they have a system to save time where they letter grade these first. The first is an A, then there's a line, then there's a paragraph, then there's a synopsis, and then there's the script under it. Or the book under it, so that it's possible for someone who can't read the English language to be a studio chief, and it's been proven over and over again. And what they did is somebody put a C by mistake over the copy of Jaws when it came in pre-publication, so Universal didn't originally bid on it. And then when it came out, they said, where is the, you know, what is, what, how? And it turned out that it was a C. It was a C. That's somebody working 9 months of their life, spitting out their imagination, their dream, their ideas, and what it gets is some dope writing a C on something else and putting it in a major studio doesn't bid on it. So you want to know why movies are, that's only, I mean, it would, you could literally have me here, God forbid, for a solid week, and I could tell you about how different movies, and people would wonder how they ever saw a good movie. Ever. How it ever got done. Well, look at King of Comedy. It was a very good script. When I showed it to the guy at Paramount, this is before, he looked at it. This is a studio chief, the third guy down. And he said, you know, you're going to have trouble getting this on. It's too original.
Were you flattered?
No, I didn't know what to say to him. I said, what do you mean? I'm going to, you're in, this is your business. You can help. What are you sitting there talking about as if it's somebody else that you have no responsibility towards this? And he became an independent producer to whom other people could say that. The trouble with Peter with this is it's too original. I felt like saying, what would you like me to really make it banal and familiar and boring? Then will you do it? And the answer probably would have been, if it resembles something that made money, yes. Pretty depressing, isn't it? But you look at Diner is a good movie this year. That's one they didn't want to release. They killed it. They put it out in St. Louis with no advertising. They were going to bury it. And it took one guy shopping it around, showing it to critics in New York, and then calling up, having the critics call up and say, I saw this movie. It's wonderful. Our review's going to be in. So if you don't want to look stupid, you better open this somewhere. And that's how Diner got out. And that's one of the most charming, wonderful films made this year. And the studios didn't want to release it, you know.
Let me reintroduce you. Paul Zimmerman's my guest, if you're just joining us. And he's a screenwriter who's based in Bucks County. He wrote the screenplay for The King of Comedy, which will be released this winter. And he's also active now in the nuclear freeze movement, which we'll be talking about in a few minutes. And for...
So you can start turning off your radios. Those of you who are only into this for the show biz.
And for about 5 years, he was the movies editor at Newsweek. Did you watch movies differently when you were going... knowing that you'd have to write about it that day, and now when you spend most of your time writing movies, do you see it differently?
Well, I see certain technical problems that the writer is dealing with. How is he going to get this? How is he going to do that? And while I was writing as a critic, I was looking, thinking, why is this going wrong? Why do I notice where I'm sitting? Why is my mind wandering? Why am I bored to death? Or why is this wonderful? And why am I having, what is the special quality that, because that's what a review is it's a record of your responses objectified. It's the subjectivity of all the things you're feeling and thinking, then turned inside out like a reversible jacket so it can be read in a cogent form. So when you're saying in a review, so-and-so gives a performance that da-da-da, what you're really saying is, while I sat there, I learned a lot. A lot of interesting things were going on in my head, and I thought, gee, this guy's terrific, and it reminded me of this. But you can't write that, or they think you're a raving idiot. So you have to say, as so-and-so, the storekeeper, Rod Steiger gives the impression and all of the suffering of Auschwitz and this, and all you're thinking is, God, this guy's really real. I mean, he doesn't seem like an actor, and in fact, it's the last time I thought Rod Steiger was really real was The Pawnbroker, but it was a terrific performance. And then you have to give reasons why, and that's what you get tired of doing as a critic. That's why it's good to leave. You get tired of giving reasons, particularly when you don't have strong feelings and no passion about a film, and you have a space to fill, and you got to churn it out.
Since scripts get accepted or rejected based on whether they could fit into an established trend. Do you go to the movies a lot to see what's happening so you'll know what the potential producers are thinking when they watch it?
I'd say some, because you can tell there are an awful lot of movies. I don't want to write trend movies. That's why I don't go that way. I mean, I write out of ideas that come to me after a long time. And, you know, I think that's one of the reasons I live in Bucks and I don't live in California, is because I don't want to be hooked into the business side of the business. I want the ideas to come out of wherever they come, out of my own head and my own craziness and what I see in my friends and the world and the newspapers and whatever the way ideas come up. I always say to people who ask me where you get your ideas, those ink bottles that have those little sayings, there's a kind of trapezoidal marble in them that say, have you ever seen those? You shake them and then a side of this thing sort of rises to the top of the black ink bottle and it says, no luck is on the way or don't whatever. It's a sort of like a trapezoidal fortune cookie in black ink. And that's the way ideas, they just sort of come up. And then you better grab them and build them into a story. But they're something you really can't will. They just sort of come to you. And if you're concerned about the business and what's trendy, all you're going to do is write somebody else's last movie that was for them an original and made money or didn't, but was a real thing for them. You're going to start copying the trends. And, you know, that's the great joke about the business is what Marshall McLuhan said, all of the people who buy the movies, who finance them, are looking at the future through rearview mirrors at the last hits, and the ones that make the money and are good are never those. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's the only sure thing is that if you do it that way, you'll be wrong most of the time. It's the only thing they follow.
When you were at Newsweek, a lot of people started careers that have since really taken off. Do you watch those careers especially closely since you were around and writing about them when they
yes,
were launched?
Yes, yes. I have a certain, that's, you know, I was not the best of all critics. I didn't have, you know, I did a good job, I think, and an honest job. But the one claim to fame, at least in my own mind, I had is that I was first on Scorsese, Lucas, Spielberg, the Czech directors, Lena Wertmüller, Alain Tanner, the Swiss director who did Jonah and a lot of others, Salamander, that there's a whole list of people whose first movies, like Sugarland Express for Spielberg and THX 1146 for Lucas, that I said, here's somebody who's really good. And I was able, for some reason, to spot that. And that's a great, if somebody asked me, like you, on a show like this, you know, what is your satisfaction from being a critic? That's one of the major ones, is having helped those people. And it's funny, I wound up working with one, Marty, and I'm very pleased in the end that he did King of Comedy, Forever the Differences, you know, and I'm glad he's as good as he is, and I think he's a real artist and deserves a lot of respect.
When you were writing for Newsweek about movies, was there a style you were supposed to be writing in?
Well, it isn't. That isn't the way it works. It's you read the magazine, you have certain space pressures. There's just so many ways you can write shorthanded and literately. And what Newsweek and Time style is a convention by which enormous amounts of information can be compressed with the minimum amount of damage into a readable and literate style. And while that's the commonality of those things. But if you read the magazine regularly, and you know, I could tell you from the magazine, if you gave me people's copy, whatever the subject, who wrote it, even though it was all for Newsweek, I'd say that's Walter Clements, that's Hubert Saul style, that's Jack Kroll style, that's Charlie Michener's, that's Doug Davis. These are the different guys. So that within that, there was enough room for the self, for you to speak in your own voice. And I think I was able with some, put it this way, you speak in your own voice with a Newsweek accent. If you can, you know, they're certainly a common voice, but within it there's a personal voice. And if you can't write in a personal voice, why bother?
Paul Zimmerman is my guest if you're just joining us. And he wrote the screenplay for The King of Comedy, a film scheduled to open this winter, which stars Jerry Lewis and Robert De Niro and directed by Martin Scorsese. And he was the Newsweek movies reviewer for about 5 years and the book reviewer for a year for Newsweek. He lives in Bucks County, which I guess is unusual for a screenwriter since...
It's unheard of.
Yeah, you're supposed to be in Los Angeles.
Yeah.
And in Bucks County, he helped to organize a nuclear freeze group, and its acronym is BAND, which
BAND,
is the Bucks
Alliance for Nuclear Disarmament. And it is an attempt to take all that energy and all that interest in the freeze and draw the groups together and have joint meetings. And the perfect example of the benefit of that is this evening, this rally, speech, whatever, where we could afford the 21 groups to bring Helen Caldicott down to Neshaminy Langhorne High School Thursday night at 7:30, come early. Whereas no one of our constituent groups could have, if they could have afforded it, they couldn't. They didn't have the person power available, because it's a tremendous amount of work, the publicity, the news releases, the logistics, the posting of posters, the getting them printed, the getting the pictures. It's a big job.
Why are you interested in this?
It started really with my wife, who was also got me into all the other things that socially, because she is she marched in Vietnam when nobody else did. She was alone walking up Fifth Avenue being spat at and yelled at. Well, there were a few other nuns and a handful of people. She heard Helen Caldicott on this show, the Terry Gross Fresh Air show, and it turned her life around. And she did a cookbook, which is available, called Great Day Cookbook, based on the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom, saying that it'll be a great day when our schools have all the money they need and the Air Force has to hold a bake sale to build a bomber. And she put out this peace cookbook, and I guess I got more and more interested. I mean, everywhere you looked in our house, there was, you know, there were books and there were pieces and there were magazine articles, and you really couldn't sit down anywhere in our house without some literature being left around. And my wife was very smart. She never proselytized, you know, or I would have probably resisted. But I got more and more involved. And it occurred to me as I read is that this whole nuclear policy is absolutely insane and dangerous. And even when it isn't killing us, literally, it's killing our economy and it's messing up our kids. And it's a very stupid way to spend money in a time of scarcity. And it's fighting the last war. And this summer, I went on the march in New York, which was wonderful. And this summer after it, Nancy Strong, who's very active in peace work, said, we were sitting there, what's the next step? And I said, well, I think we ought to get all these groups together and start pulling together. And so when I went away to California to make a living, when I got back, she'd done that. And she'd done a terrific job. And there were 40 of us who met. That's a lot of people to get out for a first meeting. And it started to form by the next time I was asked to be chairman. And I really wanted to do it. I really thought it was so important. It's the connection between this and writing is passion. I really think this is the most important thing going on. And everybody who's out there who thinks it's just one of a number of issues, you could just figure the amount of money that's just going down the toilet for this, that's driving up the interest rates and the national debt, and that's screwing up everyone's life. It's right there in weapons that are useless, absolutely useless.
Could you see yourself writing a screenplay with these ideas?
I already did. Actually, before I got involved, I wrote one with Peter Benchley that has half a producer now, somebody who's willing to put up half the money, about three leaders who are planning to sort of save the world from a nuclear holocaust and what happens. It's called The Most Powerful Man in the World, and the most powerful man is a Russian translator, who's the only one who knows what's going on and is programmed to forget. It's a comedy, but with serious mushroom overtones.
Do you have any idea how marketable nuclear issues are in the movie business now?
Everybody wants to do one now.
Really?
It's really quite disgusting.
Must be a complete turnaround.
Oh, it is. It's fad, though. And I mean, what's interesting there is it's all image out there. It's not political work. If you ask them, have you organized? Are you getting down to the local level? They don't know what you mean. They're holding big parties and they're doing movies, and that's fine. But they don't understand that you have to make people know and understand. I mean, I think the biggest enemy of the well-being of this country is the indifference. Is all the people who are listening now write to me while I'm speaking saying, well, that doesn't concern me. I've never been a peace person, or although there's those people's concern. And meanwhile, the money is cut for the special ed courses, for the loan programs, for all these social things. They're going to no purpose because these aren't bombs. They're called weapons. But they're annihilators. They're like part of a whole chain reaction. It's like putting a gun to your head when you use one, and we got to stop it.
How effective do you think a fiction film is in getting across.
Keep wanting to talk about movies, huh? And I keep wanting to talk about this thing. But go ahead. I'll give you an answer. Go ahead.
How effective do you think a fiction film is in getting across the kinds of points that you're talking about now?
I think that's fine if somebody wants to do the China syndrome. That's fine. I think generally documentaries like the ones that are going around now that are put out with Helen Caldicott, either, you know, A War Without Winners or The Last Epidemic or The Atomic Cafe, that seems a more comfortable form to get the message across. I mean, while movies have an educational function, their main function is to change the way we see emotionally and artistically and creatively. And when you get programmatic, you lose that kind of focus, and you get a didactic movie that bores the hell out of everyone, I think. And I think it's a bad starting point for creativity, a message. I think the message, that's why I'm not doing it that way. That's why I'm taking a month out, and I'm trying to do what I can with the skills that I have to see that people learn about this. If they're interested, they'll come and hear Helen Caldicott. I mean, we had this with our supervisors race in Upper Makefield. I thought, well, if you bring a supervisor, the guy who's going to run the township government, into a housing development, and you say from 3 to 5, all you have to do is go around the corner and say hello, you'll be fed, and you'll be taken care of, and you can talk to the person who's going to decide what your property taxes is, your school taxes, the quality of your life. We got 8 people out of 200, you know, and you just wonder, people have to get involved. I mean, they have to for their government's sake. They think, oh, well, it's somehow disloyal to hold these rallies. But a government that isn't nourished by this kind of thing, I mean, we could still be in Vietnam by now if it hadn't been. And this is not a left-right issue. This is just a survival issue. It's a question of how to use your money. We have very limited amount of money. If you build an MX missile and you spend $34 billion on it and you don't know where to put it and you're going to put it in a clump and you have to spend 2 years looking around, I mean, that's such a pitiful waste. And here are these other programs being cut. I mean, do you want to remove the soapbox now and go on to something else?
Well, I'm sure you've asked yourself what effective action is for someone in your position or for anyone, for that matter. I mean, because a lot of times when you feel really committed to an issue or a cause and you ask yourself, well, but what can I do about it? The answer isn't necessarily obvious about what effective
action
is.
Well, there are lots of things you can do. You can write everybody is called on at a different level. It seems to me the first thing you can do is educate yourself. And if you educate yourself, in other words, if you read, there in the daily newspapers, people who want to know right now, tomorrow, there was a piece today in the Inquirer. There will be one tomorrow. This issue will come up in the congressional districts. Jim Coyne voted against the freeze. He killed the freeze. Peter Kostemeyer voted for the freeze, supports the freeze. You have choices to make. This will be a debate there. It will come in the newspaper. If you educate yourself and you get angry and you get puzzled and you want to know more, the way will open for you to do something. Out of ignorance, action does not come. Out of worrying, out of fatalism. I mean, my wife was trying to get people involved, and they'd say, what good does it do? I can't do. That kind of fatalism is a form of suicide or numbing. That first you find out, you read Jonathan Schell's book, you read something, and once you know, then something happens. If people get mad, find a way to do something, and people who don't care never find a way.
There's recently
Is that
been,
clear?
Yeah, no, I don't know what you're talking about. Recently, there's been a lot of like Hollywood stars, like Fonda and Redford, who are putting their names behind causes. I wonder if you think that's effective or not.
It helps raise money, and money's effective. That's all. I think that's their privilege. Thank God there are a few of them who worry a little more about something besides the, you know, the wrinkle under their eye or where their last picture did in this. I always thought that's a kind of unfair rap. People can't believe that if you're a movie star, you're really interested in anything else. And I think it's their shallowness that reflects on, that there could be things more important than top billing, and there are.
Well, I just wanted to mention that Helen Caldicott will be speaking at the group that you helped organize on Thursday, September 30th. That's this Thursday at 7:30.
At the Chamonix-Langhorne High School in Langhorne, I guess, off Route 1 bypass. And there will be a lot of groups there willing to help you sign up and work if you are so moved afterwards. Peter Kostemeyer will also be speaking, and so will Jim Coyne, was invited and didn't come. So that's the evening.
And for any more information, you can call 641-7219 or 943-9708. The second is the evening number. The first is the day number. So again, that's 641-7219 and 943-9708. My guest is Paul Zimmerman, who helped found this group that we were just discussing, whose acronym is BAND, the Bucks Alliance for Nuclear Disarmament. He's also a screenwriter based in Bucks County who wrote the screenplay The King of Comedy, which opens this winter, which is pretty soon.
It's not soon enough.
Are you nervous about it?
No, I'm not. I'm not nervous. No, I'm not. I'm anxious to see. I'm really very curious. You know, 13 years is a long time to be nervous. So I'm not nervous anymore. I'll just be glad when this is all over. 13 years to pin your career on one event, you eventually sort of wear out that kind of energy, and you begin to kind of lock into a fatalism about that. Sometimes fatalism isn't that bad, particularly when you have no control. And in that case, the screenwriter really doesn't have much control. He has input, but not control. There's a difference.
Well, good luck with King of Comedy and with your other screenplays. And thanks very much for talking with us, Jenny.
And thank you for having me.